is begotten by God and knows God. Anyone who fails to love can never have known God, because God is love. My dear people, since God has loved us so much, we too should love one another. No one has ever seen God, but as long as we love one another, God will live in us, and His love will be complete in us. God is love, and anyone who lives in love lives in God, and God lives in him. Love will come to its perfection in us when we can face the day of judgment without fear, because even in this world we have become as He is. In love there can be no fear, but fear is driven out by perfect love, because to fear is to expect punishment, and anyone who is afraid is still imperfect in love. We are to love, then, because He first loved us. Anyone who says, "I love God," and hates his brother is a liar, since a man who does not love the brother that he can see cannot love God whom he has never seen. So this is the commandment that He has given us, that anyone who loves God must also love his brother. What a great thrill it is to be here with you and to worship together with you, to gather around the table, to commit ourselves again this week, today, to God again, and to one another again as we commit ourselves again in this service of eating the supper together. May God bless us and help us. What a wonderful experience it is to renew old acquaintances and to meet new ones. We're so thankful for your presence here with us today. Brother Moore, I appreciate your selection of those readings. They complement the text for the hour. I'm reading this morning from 1 Timothy, the first chapter, and verse 5. Whereas the aim of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience, and sincere faith. The Apostle Paul gives these three brief statements and calls them the end of the charge. This is the ultimate goal. This is the ultimate charge. He says in the next verse that some people, having swerved from these, have wandered away. And then in verse 19 of this first chapter, he says that these people have made shipwreck of their faith. This passage of Scripture, I think, is one of the most important in all the New Testament. It's one of the most important in all of the letters of the New Testament. We're living in a time when we witness the shipwreck of many lives. Are you aware of the fact that emotional illness is the number one threat to America's stability? Emotional illness is the number one disease in this country in which we live. Are you aware that there are over 700,000 people today confined in an emotional institution or an institution for emotionally ill people? Are you aware that there are 250,000 new admissions into these institutions every year? I call them emotional institutions or institutions for the emotionally ill because of the fact that I'm convinced, at least, that our illness in America today is not organic, it's functional. And these are not mentally ill people, they're emotionally ill. And we've got today over 9 million alcoholics in America. 9 million. There are over 200,000 new alcoholics every year. People losing contact with reality. Our prisons are cram-packed with wrecked ships. The rocks along the shorelines of our age are littered with broken homes and juvenile delinquents that come from such broken homes. Yes, we're living in a time, like Paul referred to, when many people are making shipwreck of their lives. Many people make shipwrecks of their lives for the same reasons that ships find themselves lost and find themselves destroyed. The principles of safe navigation have been ignored. And today, I think you can point to the very fact that people are ignoring the safe navigation principles. This is the reason why so many people are making shipwreck of their lives today. Perhaps you're here this morning and you're one of these that really is going toward disaster, you're going toward shipwreck, and maybe you don't even know it. The Apostle Paul refers to these three things and says, the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. He says these things are of utmost importance to you. They actually regulate all three relationships in life: your relationship to yourself, your relationship to other people, and your relationship to God. And unless you give serious attention to the incorporating of these things into your life, I maintain that you're on a collision course with disaster in your own personal life. I want to talk to you about them for the next 3 weeks. Today I want to take just the first one, love out of a pure heart. Paul could have gone to the extent that he would talk about hate and how terrible it is, but he doesn't. I think he assumes that you know that. He's talking to Christians. We could say that hate is the most destructive force in the world and go into all the manner of detail about what hate will do for you, but that's not the end of the charge, just eliminating hate. Paul says the end of the charge is the incorporating into our lives this powerful, potent force of Christianity that is called love. Love is that which brought Christianity about. For God so loved the world that He gave His Son. Love is that which activates and which propagates Christianity, in the sense that Paul says to the Corinthians in the 2 Corinthian letter that love constrains us. It's the love of Christ that constrains us. But love also, in the sense of identifying and in the sense of what you might call ratifying benevolent activities, it makes what we do of meaning. Paul said, though I give all of my goods to feed the poor, and if I give my body to be burned, but don't have love, it doesn't profit a thing. God is love, John says in 1 John 4. And Jesus also said that love identifies the Christian. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have love for each other, as was just read a moment ago. And in the 1 Corinthian letter, chapter 13, Paul says that love never ends, and that love is actually better or more important or more lasting, at least, than faith and hope. The greatest of these is love. I think of all the things that I could have said to you today. I came to the conclusion that the best thing that I could say to you today would be to speak on this subject of love, maybe in a different way than what you were expecting. I'm not primarily talking about agape. I think the more accurate description would be the love that could be defined as what you like, what you want, what do you desire. The love that is within you as far as these are the things that you really and truly enjoy. This is what you like. Maybe this is more akin to phileo than it is the agape love. But I'm simply saying that of all the principles of Christianity, I would suggest and suspect strongly that the thing that more critically determines your course in life and affects your destiny is this one simple thing of what do you enjoy, what do you like, what do you want, what do you desire. Because young people, tell me what you want, tell me what you desire, and by the way, I can stand right here and tell you either what you are or what you're going to very shortly become, because you're in the process of becoming what you like it or not. You're in the process of becoming what you want. And if you could just draw a line around what you really enjoy, what your heart just delights in, and just draw a line around it, pick it out and set it over about 10 years from now, and you'll have a very accurate picture of what you are and a very accurate picture now of what you're going to be then. What do you like and what do you want? Luther said this. He said, that upon which your heart relies and in which your heart delights has in effect become your God. And you know what? Whether we want to or not, invariably we begin to look like our God. We begin to look like what we want. We begin to look like what our mind thinks about all day. We begin to look like what we rest upon and what our heart delights in. This is the way we begin to look. You can mark it down, and it's a frightening thing.
to think that life could be so determined by simply the wants of our hearts. But that's what I think Paul is talking about here. He says the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart. Don Quixote in the play said this, "Don't pursue pleasure lest you overtake it." And for whatever that's worth and whatever he meant by it, there's a lot of truth in that. What are you pursuing? May I suggest that don't pursue what you would not like to overtake, because just as surely as you do pursue it, you're going to overtake it. Solomon said in the book of Proverbs, he made the statement that you ought to keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. And what we're talking about today are the issues of life. They're the very gut and core. They're the very fiber. They're the very warp and woof of your whole life. And if you miss it here, and if I could pinpoint one, I don't know whether I would pinpoint this one, but I think I would. I would say, of all the things that you must be able to determine and to control in your life, you're going to have to control what you want. You're going to have to control your desires. I think that the new birth is wrapped up in this one thing, incidentally. But anyway, let's go on just a bit. The finer tuning. Did you ever see a radio that had a tuning knob, and then behind it, it had a larger, finer tuner that you could get it right down and zeroed in on the station? That's what this second part of this says. Paul says the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart. Out of a pure heart. And that qualifies this considerably. He didn't just say that the end of the charge is love. A lot of people are saying that today. Oh, that all there is love. Well, all right, love out of a pure heart. There are a lot of qualifications that the Lord puts on love. And there are a lot of facets of it that you might not even recognize as love. But what I want to do this morning is to see if you can't see what this means by saying that love out of a pure heart is what is so essential. You know, it was upon the pure in heart that Jesus placed his blessing when he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." It was the pure in heart. Well, who was Paul referring to when he said here that the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart? Well, he was talking about at least two different things, and let me just say these, and there may be others that we could bring in if we have time. One of these is just what it says. It is a pure heart. Are your motives pure? What are your motives? Do you know yourself well enough to know what your motives are? Why are you what you are? Be it said to our eternal disgrace that much of the Bible is written as an exposé of the ulterior motives of men. How sad. What a tragedy it is that we're so wrapped up in ulterior motives, and we are so wrapped up many times in subterfuge, that the Bible had to be written as an exposé of these ulterior subterfuge measures of ours. And how sad it is. But the day that the Pharisees came up to Jesus, and they sided up to him and said, "Teacher, we know that you are true, and that you teach truthfully the way of God, and that you don't really show preference to people because you don't give any time or any place to positions of men." But it says Jesus knew their hearts, and he knew that they hated his guts. They couldn't stand him. And yet here they came, this subterfuge, waxing eloquent, and they had it all planned out how they could get next to the Lord and try to trick him into letting his guard down and saying something by which they could convict him. Jesus said, "You hypocrites, show me a coin." They had come and asked him about whether to pay tribute to Caesar or not. But the height of this kind, I could go into that, but won't have time this morning. But the height of this kind of subterfuge dealing with people, the height of this thing of ulterior motives, got to the place that in Judas Iscariot, it's almost flung out the window and it becomes a mockery as Judas Iscariot came up to Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane and actually betrayed the Son of God with a kiss. How dare? How dare him do it? But he did it. And it's gone down in history. He became known as the man who originated the kiss of death. The mafia and the underworld today, when they mark out a man and make a contract on him for his death, do you know how they indicate that they're going to get him? They kiss him. That originated with Judas Iscariot. To the Galatians, Paul said, "Be careful of these people who..." What did he say? "Be careful of these people who..." Let me read it. "They make much of you. They make much of you, but for no good purpose. They want to shut you out that you may make much of them." And what's he talking about? He was talking about these people that come up and make a great deal of ado over you, you know, and all this hubbub and falderoy. Well, they do it simply because they want to get the advantage over you and shut you out so that you'll be the one knocking and wanting in, and they'll be the ones to come and let you in. Paul said, "Be careful of these Judaizing teachers." That's what they want. When Jude wrote his letter, he said, "These people that flatter people for the sake of advantage." Flatter people for the sake of advantage. Now, I'm talking about something probably that not any of you knows about. I do not suspect for a moment that this is the plane of conduct upon which most members of the church live. I don't think for a moment that we're down in that gutter. I don't believe it. I do not believe that you're here because it helps your business. I do not believe that you have this, that you're here to worship because it gets you in with somebody. I don't believe that. Sometimes we do that as we're courting, but we usually learn better and we become Christians through maybe going to church with a girl that we love. Maybe there is an ulterior motive, but you'll learn. You keep coming. You'll do all right. But a lot of people in the religious world, we are told, find themselves involved in church activity because it's good business and you associate with the right kinds of people and all this. But I don't believe that that's true in the church. But I am aware of the fact that many motives in the world are ulterior motives, and that this kind of a life that's well balanced cannot be built upon a life that expresses itself in ulterior motives and around whom subterfuge is erected to where it hides your real wants and your real desires. And actually, instead of showing people that you really and truly love them, you actually are in there trying to get something out of them. I don't believe that's the way we live. But what Paul is talking about has another thing about it. It talks about another degree of sincerity that perhaps catches about all of us. And that's this degree of purity of heart that means a sincere heart in the sense that it is not hypocritical either, that it is genuine, it is true, and it simply says that my actions are the actual reflection of what I want. They're the actual reflections of my desires. In the book of Romans, chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, the Apostle Paul makes this, he urges us to do this. Let love be genuine. I think that's what he was talking about when he said that this love that issues out of a pure heart. Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Why do you do what you do? Do you really and truly like what's right? Or are you just doing it because you feel like you ought to do it? Do you really and truly enjoy doing what's right? You know, it was upon this kind of person. Jesus said, blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness, after right living. Is this an expression or is this a description of you? How's your appetite for righteousness? How's your appetite for righteousness, for right living? Do you really feel that you've got a real great appetite for it? Or are you just kind of nibbling around? You know you ought to eat, you know, but your appetite's not really very good. So you just eat because you have to stay alive. You know, there are a lot of people that live like that. They don't have any appetite. And yet they know I've got to eat, I've got to live, so I just have to eat. And so they eat just enough to get by, enough to keep alive. How many of you are like that on campus? You don't really want to do what's right. You're just bursting at the seams to do something that's wrong, and yet you don't want to be called up before the goodbye committee, so you do what's right. Really, all deep down inside you, you can't really stand that way of living at all, and you'd give anything in the world that you could just go out and just do what you want to do, because you really don't have much time for this doing right, and yet you do it. Why do you do what you do? Some Christians are like that, you know. You find yourself walled in a prison where you can't do really what you want to do. Which one of these explains your life? Some Christians, you know, you can't... Well, let's just say it like this. You can't do everything you want to do, Christians. Does that express you? Or can we say this is where you are, that you ought to be able to do whatever you want to do, that the Christian ought to be able to do what he wants to do? Or there's a third plane of living where it just simply says the Christian can do anything he wants to do. Which of these describes your life? I do not think that... I can't say what I think about you because I don't know about you. But I do know this, that there are three different levels of behavior. One is almost an animal level. One is a slave level. The other is a free man level. Why do you do what you do? Do you do it because you like to do what's right, because you love God, because you want to do His will? Or do you do it because simply that you feel like you ought to do it and people are looking at you and you've got to do it in order to stay on good terms? Well, you'll tell a lot about yourself if you can answer that question. But then there's a second thing that he talked about here. Let love be genuine. Outdo one another, he said. Let love, or love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do you love people genuinely? Do you really and truly love people? Well, here's a good test. How do you react when someone honors someone else instead of honoring you? Does it make you jealous? Do you throb with enthusiasm at someone else is being honored? When Brother Gaines was given the award for the outstanding alumnus of Harding this past Friday night, one of the people there, the MC of the thing, told me that he actually cried. Not because he didn't get it, But he actually cried because of the fact that it meant so much. He felt it to Brother Gaines. Brother Gaines was overwhelmed. And he sensed this enjoyment and this appreciation of Brother Gaines. And he enjoyed it with him. And I bet there wasn't a dry eye in that audience. I bet there wasn't a heart that wasn't up in the throat. Dislocated heart. I hope that's true. I hope there wasn't some miserable soul sitting over there saying, "I've done more than that old man. I ought to have it. I've been coming to this thing every year for 15 years. Do you love people genuinely? You know, these three men, Hacker, Jones, and Allen, they're the three stooges on campus. You know, they have this thing going among them where they cut each other at will. Man, they do it with relish, and they just enjoy it so much. And they enjoy getting cut. It's not that they just enjoy cutting. They enjoy cutting each other and getting cut. Sometimes they get cut while they're cutting, but... And when they're standing looking out the window, you know, while they're lecturing, they're standing there meditating. They're not thinking about the lecture. They're thinking about what they're going to say back to him because he said that to me in chapel. But you know, those men love each other. They wouldn't mention each other's names if they didn't love. They have a sick way of expressing it. But they really love each other. And they are as interested in each other being honored. They almost get as much enjoyment out of each other being honored as themselves. And I think that's a wonderful thing. No, they wouldn't even mention each other's name in public if they didn't feel that this was a way in which they could kind of in a backhand way honor each other. And it's wonderful. Do you really and truly honor people and enjoy honoring people and enjoy other people honoring them? Do you outdo each other in showing honor? Well, much could be said about it, but let me just simply say this. I know that there is a time when our heads have to act and wait till our hearts catch up. I know that. I know that there are times when we really don't want to do what's right. And yet, because of our commitment to Christ and a higher commitment, we do what's right. And I know there are times when we really don't enjoy, perhaps, having people into our homes. And yet, a higher commitment to their good causes us to say, "We want you to be a part of us." And we invite them and we become hospitable. I know that there are times when our head has to act and let our hearts catch up later. But brethren, let me say this. Oh, the misery. Oh, the heartache and the headache that comes from this thing of always being in a position of wanting to want, but never wanting. Of wanting to love, but never loving. Of always wanting to believe, but not really believing. Wanting to trust, but never trusting. Always being one step back from reality as far as the kingdom is concerned. Always feeling like we're on the outside looking in. Always feeling like we're back here one step away from the realities of the kingdom of God that make people want and make them love and make them trust and make them believe and make them serve rather than just knowing they ought to serve, they ought to want, and they ought to believe, and they ought to trust. I do not believe that the kingdom of God is a kingdom of oughts. I believe it's a kingdom of wants ultimately. Obviously, Paul says this is the end of the charge. I'm thankful he didn't say it's the beginning. I'm thankful he did not say that you, in order to become a Christian, you've got to love what's right, and you've got to love all this, and you've got to instinctively, because of what you are, you've got to love these things and be the... I'm glad he didn't say that's the beginning. He did say it's the end. And I maintain that as long as we stand in the rut of ought, that I ought to do it, and I should do it, I know I must do it, and yet never arrive at the reality in that position where we say, "I genuinely love you. I genuinely want your good. I genuinely believe. I genuinely love God." And it thrills my soul, and I find myself being enraptured by the very presence of God and by the very presence of my brother. Until we arrive at that position where our oughts become our wants, I suspect that we're almost standing always back of the kingdom, just kind of looking into it with expectancy, but never really participating in it. Somewhere along the line, our oughts have got to become our wants. Or else you're going to end up a schizophrenic, always divided, knowing you should, but never enjoying it. Knowing you must, and yet never really experiencing it. Always more or less washing our hands with our gloves on. What a frustrating thing in life that is. Listen to this. It's easy to think that I ought is the end, the ultimate Christian ambition. But ought wears thin at 9:45 when you really want to go fishing. I should sounds good, but it's as dead as wood when it comes to doing what's right. For the good that I could, what my head knows I should, I usually don't in a tight. Somewhere in life, in all of our strife, there must come a noble transition that turns fear into love and ought into want. This is the nobler condition. For if all our teaching just has us reaching for that which I should or I ought, I strongly surmise that we've closed our eyes to the real truth that Jesus has taught. I want is the thing that gives life its zing and puts our money where our mouth is, that gives us direction and provides our correction and keeps our feet where no doubt is. So when you would do a thing that you should, but know from your past that you won't, if you have faith as a grain, you'll find it's no pain to do what you ought if you want. I think this is what he means when he says that the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart. I think he's referring here to this pure love and this sincere love, this sincere heart, to where our wants are what our oughts are, and our oughts have become what we really and truly want. I think the key to all of this is simply the having of a single heart. You know, you can't love two masters. You're not made like that emotionally. For the same reason, you can't walk down two roads at the same time. You're joined together at your hips, and you just aren't made that way physically, unless you come apart. And that's why so many people are coming apart today emotionally. They're trying to serve two masters. Jesus says you can't do it. You'll either end up hating one, despising, or loving the other, or clinging to one, despising the other. You can't love them or serve them both. I don't guess, well, I know there are many superficial alternatives to God. There are many superficial challenges to God's sovereignty. But there's only one real challenge to his sovereignty, and that's yourself. Men are going to be lovers of themselves if they're not lovers of God. I know there are things now that you don't really and truly want to do. I find myself in that position. But I found this, that if we will love, or if we come to the place that we can love Jesus Christ for what he is, then we will do his will in spite of what we are in our imperfect love. And if we'll continue to love him because of what he is, then he'll let us grow to the point that we'll realize the end of our charge, this love out of a pure heart. You know where you are today. I don't. I know where I am, and I'm not satisfied with it. But I don't know where you are. You may be in prison, in the prison house of your own wants, because you know you can't do like you want. You're doing like others know you ought and like you know you ought. But look, is there any way that I can encourage you to strip off the superficiality, strip off the things that would keep you bound up in terror and in jail all of your life, and just simply come to the Lord Jesus Christ and commit yourself, throw yourself at his feet, beg and plead. He'll accept you. He's already invited you. But come and give your life to him, turn your back upon sin, confess your faith in him. But if you're already a Christian, strip off these things of superficiality and begin searching for this love out of a pure heart.